all of this other stuff, took it into Sam Stevens, and Sam Stevens said basically, we're going to let this be sorted out in criminal court. So Richard is left at this point with the option, and of course, today I am composing a letter requesting that I know every move that Claudia Easterby is going to take.
That's
for the next week.
That's the Gottschalk's manager.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Where she banks, where she goes to get her food, where she goes to the doctor, every vehicle that she might drive and the license plate number, every route that she might take to go to any of these places, because at this point she can place herself within 25 yards of Richard whenever she wants, and claim that he's following her.
Mm-hmm.
It's absolutely insane.
So Stevens seems to not be too concerned about this, huh?
Stevens, I mean, in the face of absolute evidence that this is going on, that they are not interpreting the restraining order in the manner that the judge intended it to be determined, and that there is, in fact, a memo from the sheriff's department stating this is how it should be interpreted. And, I left out one detail, and that is that at when this restraining order was first issued, quickly wrote a letter to Hemingway and to the sheriff's department saying, please clarify how you're going to interpret the restraining order so that I have some sense of what I can and cannot do. They came back to him saying, we can't give legal advice. Now they have issued a memo as to how they're going, of course, behind his back without him knowing it. This memo came out from Hemingway as to how they were going to enforce it.
And how is that?
And that is that they're now going to have her park in front of the they've advised her to park in the front there.
Well, this is a way of creating.
Not in the employee parking
lot. But isn't this inappropriate? This is quite appropriate because it creates a quickly free zone.
Yeah, right. Well, she is. Evidently, that's what they're figuring now. They've figured out how to use this. And of course, wherever she is, it's a quickly free zone. And so she stands within 25 yards of him. He's violating the restraining order. It's an outrage, and several people were shocked at Stephen's cavalier attitude towards this, including people that.
Was Stephen seen in the vicinity of this porno theater?
So at any rate, the next move is federal court, which should be happening. In fact, tomorrow he's going to ask for an immediate injunction, based on the fact that they're failing to. Clean up their own act, and that his life is in immediate peril at all times at this point arrested.
Certainly his liberty, no question
about
it.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Well, this shows us, I guess, even with an individual as knowledgeable and ready to go to court as Richard, and knowledgeable in the ways of the court, and really careful about his own. I think he's very careful of where he treads because he speaks very. Outspokenly about issues, and when he goes to court, he declines to go beyond the bar. Most people walk up to the judge's podium.
Uh-uh.
He refuses to do that, believing that in so doing he increases the jurisdiction the court has over him, and he simply speaks to the judge from his seat in the audience.
Right.
Does he stand up when the judge enters the room? I don't know what he does.
I've never noticed one way or another, but
at least he doesn't fart when the judge enters the room, which might be more appropriate.
His actual first problem came when his son was trying to get into the military and needed to get some little misdemeanor or something off of his record, and the judge kept, this was in Southern California, judge kept stepping on his son's, son kept trying to explain what he was doing, that he was joining the Navy, and finally Richard stood up in the back and said, if you just shut up and listen, you'd figure out what was going on here. And the judge said something about holding him in contempt, and he says, you're right, Your Honor, I have nothing but contempt for this court. At which point he was dragged off and taken to jail.
Sounds like me and Heather Morris.
Yeah, exactly. And,
well, I know Richard is really got a lot of, he's done a lot of courageous personal action, and I'm hoping that that can be generalized and the information made clear enough to folks in summarized form so that they can use similar processes. I know that you two have worked on verified complaints as a way of dealing with tickets, so you you challenge an officer bringing in a ticket saying, no, a ticket is not enough in court. You have to have a verified complaint from the district attorney or the city attorney.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that you've talked about the take me to a magistrate defense, whereby you sign your ticket, but then you later go in and rescind the signature and say, hey, I need to be taken to a magistrate first. A series of processes to essentially stop the police from harassment stops and return the judicial system and the to the people from whom it, you know, originally supposedly came. Actually, it probably was imposed on us to begin with, but should have come. We're talking to Attorney Kate Wells, and you're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. The phone line is occupied right now, but after we're finished with this interview, I invite you all to call in at 427-3772 with your comments and thoughts. Kate, you also were involved in a case involving the sleeping ban, where you've been an outspoken advocate for homeless people around that issue. You want to talk about that case?
Yeah, we have a case where a gentleman by the name of Dennis Ream was in his camper meditating one morning at 8 o'clock in the morning and heard the long arm of the law pounding on his on the outside of his vehicle.
The big fist of the law.
Right. He became alarmed because he was pounding so hard that he was sure that he was going to put a dent in it. So he stopped his meditating and came out the door, and the cop says, I heard you in there snoring. And he says, well, no, you didn't. You heard me in there doing my deep breathing exercises meditating. At any rate, we went to trial, unfortunately, in front of Mulligan because it was too late to challenge his jurisdiction when I got into the case.
Always disqualify Mulligan, all you folks out there, if you ever have a ticket.
And Mulligan heard the evidence, heard a very eloquent description of what he was doing and how he was doing it from Dennis, and heard the cops say, well, yeah, I heard him snoring, didn't see him, nothing more than that, and of course it was guilty as charged, and they fined him the usual $2 or $3.
Mm-hmm. That's the usual fine. Although the warrant on which he showed me a copy of says $197.
Yeah, all I can think of is that that's the additional charge for issuing the warrant or the additional fine.
But
he
apparently stated he would not pay that charge, and so
right.
And then, of course, this rather interesting question came up, which has been raised by past activists, Robert Flory and Linda Edwards and Dave Jacobs, to name three, that because the sleeping ban is an infraction crime, generally speaking, it is infraction, and in particular a non-vehicular infraction, one that not involving a vehicle.
Right.
If you fail to pay the fine, the courts only does not have a recourse to put you in jail, because in 1970, when the infraction category was created, or most recent kind of changes were made around that issue, the courts of the legislature said that if it were an infraction crime, you do not get a public defender and you do not get a jury trial, but you cannot be jailed. And so, accordingly, in 1980, the state attorney general, in an extensive opinion, ruled that you cannot put a person in jail for even for failing to pay in an infraction infraction crime. Now,
what it actually says is that the punishment, that the number of days that they can punish you in jail can be no more than the underlying offense would have borne. So, in other words, if it's a misdemeanor and the maximum would have been 30 days, you can't do any more than 30 days. Obviously, since it's an infraction, it can't do any because the underlying infraction does not involve, in fact, any jail time. Now, the key issue here being the right to a jury trial before you go to jail, since you were deprived of that right in an infraction. Obviously, then to turn around and bootstrap by saying, okay, well, we couldn't do it for the infraction, but we can now for your failure to pay the fine for the infraction would be to deprive you of a jury trial prior to them in fact taking away your liberty. So
I'm looking at the Attorney General's decision here.
Right.
Of 1980, May 14th, in a case in San Luis Obispo, actually by George Duke Magian when he was Attorney General before he became governor.
Yeah.
And the question that was raised was, does the power of a municipal court to enforce the payment of a fine by imprisonment apply to a violation of state law, which amounts to an infraction? Does the court possess the inherent power to enforce the payment of a fine by imprisonment for violations of local ordinances?
Uh-huh.
And does the court have the power to enforce a judgment of a fine by imprisonment when at the time it imposes judgment and authorizes payment of the fine by installments, it does not also provide that in default of payment the defendant could be imprisoned.
Right.
And the conclusions were all good ones for defendants.
Right.
The power of municipal
right.
court to enforce the payment of a fine by imprisonment is restricted by Penal Code 1205,
right.
which
right.
precludes imprisonment for non-payment
now
of a
this
fine.
This doesn't include vehicular infractions, which are under 40508. Of the vehicle code that they
there is a special law which allows them to charge right. you with an additional crime, a misdemeanor
right.
crime, which
right.
means you get a jury trial and a public
right.
defender if you fail to pay, let's say, a traffic ticket infraction.
Right.
So that doesn't include it. But the sleeping ban is not a vehicular infraction.
Exactly.
And interestingly enough, when it shows up on the court calendars, it says FTP, which I guess is an abbreviation for failure to pay.
Mm-hmm.
But there is no code section, and when I went to the law library and talked to Pat, the law librarian, the same evening that you took this case to court, she, in her extensive research into over the internet and so forth and on the computer, could not find such a code section. So it's in addition to, it apparently being against the law or unconstitutional to require someone to pay a fine or to go to jail for not paying a non-vehicular infraction fine. It is also, they're charging
failure
you.
Failure to give notice.
They're not telling you what they're charging you
right.
with. There's no
the
code
Sixth
section
Amendment.
They're presenting, and so you don't even know how to defend the case, which
Absolutely.
Is a violation of the Sixth Amendment of the Constitution.
Which is the argument I made at the time.
The right to be informed of the charges right. against you.
Right. Yeah, you have every right to have notice and an opportunity to prepare a defense, and obviously not knowing what it is that you have offended, it doesn't give
right.
you any chance to defend yourself.
Well, you spoke before a referee Patterson, who I guess wasn't Mulligan, who was running that court at that point.
Right.
And what was his decision in this?
Well, interestingly enough, his decision was to avoid having to make a decision by saying that the warrant that they issued in the first place was invalid for some reason. First of all, he rebuffed what I had to say by saying, well, I don't know what code section. I'm going to have to do some research on that, so sit down. So we sat down, and the clerk then... He went through several other cases, and then the clerk handed him something, and he called us back up, and he said, well, it appears that the warrant was improperly issued.
Now, wait a minute. Did he ever find the elusive code section?
Oh, no.
Of course not.
No, absolutely not.
So what this means is, and this is very significant to me, it means that every time you see FTP
right.
on a court calendar in the court, and you'll see lots of little FTPs all over the
right.
place, these are all based on an imaginary code section.
Yes.
That doesn't exist.
Right. Well, it could be the 1205, but then the problem is, see, that the 1205 would work for them in a misdemeanor, but it won't work in an infraction, a non-vehicular infraction.
So every single non-vehicular infraction FTP that's up there, in essence, is a fraud on the
that's
public.
Right. That's right.
In our
that's
court
right.
system.
Absolutely.
And it's pretty hard for people to believe that the court system is methodically, habitually, daily lying to the
putting
public.
Putting people in jail.
And squeezing
that they
money out of
put in jail legally.
It's amazing.
It is.
Yeah.
It's an outrage. And it happens, you know, it's happening in many other circumstances. Richard Quigley is fighting one in Contra Costa County now, which could have statewide ramifications. Right now, they summarily suspend your driver's license upon a clerk notifying the DMV that you have failed to appear. A clerk.
And what's the significance of this?
The significance of this is that a failure to appear is, first of all, the code section states that it has to be proved beyond a reasonable doubt. It's a criminal section that you willfully failed to appear.
It's also a misdemeanor, so you're entitled to a jury trial.
Absolutely.
And a public defender.
Absolutely. But instead, they summarily suspend your driver's license based on just... You know, so in other words, if you were ill and in the hospital and couldn't make it, or, you know, I mean, any number of reasons which wouldn't be willful failure to appear,
mm-hmm.
They still go ahead and summarily suspend your driver's license without a judge ever once being involved in it.
Well, I suppose the DMV codes could be more restrictive than the law. They could say that the driver's license is a privilege and we don't need to prove beyond
right.
a reasonable doubt and all
right.
this sort of thing,
right.
but regarding failure to appear, that's another issue that I brought to your attention in the past,
mm-hmm.
and again in the case of a woman accused of a sleeping ban violation. She, I believe it was a woman, who I went into Mulligan's court with her, and she asked me what to do, and I gave her my advice, which was one of the charges against her was a failure to appear.
Right.
And it had a little I next to it.
Infraction, yeah.
Which I guess is their way of saying, hey, this is an infraction, so we don't need to give you a jury trial, and we don't need to, you know, to provide a public defender.
Yeah.
But then I went next door to the law library, and
there
again,
is no such thing.
Talking to trustee law librarian Pat, we spent an hour looking for a looking over the failure to appear statute. It is a misdemeanor in cases, unless
because you can go to jail.
Right.
That's
the
definition.
It is possible for a defendant, through his or her own voluntary agreement, to lower certain misdemeanors to infractions. There's a certain number of them that can be, but
you have to agree.
One, you have to agree, and two, these have to be a part of a particular class of misdemeanors.
Right.
And
right.
I'm not aware, we weren't able to ascertain that this was one of them, and she certainly never gave her permission.
Right.
So Mulligan, when she stood up and said, I'd like a jury trial on this, Your Honor, said, this is an infraction, you're not going to get one, was either willfully lying, and I suspect he was, because he's been informed of this fact before. I informed him of this 3 or 4 years ago when he was doing the same thing, or else he is, you know, he's become senile and has forgotten.
Right.
I'm not quite sure what the story is, but I know that people are suffering as a consequence of this kind of judicial, what do I say, corruption, a malfeasance. And of course, you send a letter to the Commission for Judicial Performance, and what do you get, you know?
Yeah.
They stick their thumb up their ass and laugh at you.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I suppose it's good to keep a record, just like it's good to send in letters to the Citizens Police Review Board.
Yeah.
But maybe, I guess you were talking about in Dennis's case, the warrant was, should we say, Judge or Referee Patterson said that this warrant for him was illegal, and he was not going to, was improperly put together.
Mm-hmm.
But then he made another remarkable statement, right? He said that one would issue within 24 hours again.
Right. So, which means that you now have to pay before 5 o'clock tomorrow, or the same process will take place.
Even though there's no new information, no new codes have been written by the legislature, it's still illegal to issue a warrant under an infraction, which involves a jailing process.
And interestingly enough, his warrant actually reads on where they put the code section, the warrant that they had issued for him. Where they put the code section, they don't put a code section that has anything to do with a failure to pay. They put the code section as the underlying county ordinance infraction, the
6.36.010A and B, or B.
Right.
That is, of course, the sleeping ban.
Infraction.
The sleeping ban is an infraction for which you cannot be at jail.
Exactly.
And a warrant will take you to jail.
That's right.
So
that's
the
right.
question is,
that they are
is
jailing people illegally.
So, Kate, does this mean we should suggest NATO bomb the courthouse? I mean, these are human rights violations.
In the words of President Clinton, we have to teach our youth to learn to use words, issue
an ultimatum that the courts start obeying the law and stop harassing, doing the homeless cleansing.
Absolutely.
If they don't, we'll send in federal observers, arrest the judges, and if that doesn't work, if they refuse to surrender, a little strategic bombing of maybe the judge's men's room. A few innocent people may die, but that's war, right?
Yeah, war is hell, yeah.
I'd like to point out for anyone listening that I'm not really suggesting that anyone bomb the courthouse, which would be a federal offense. Even suggesting it would be a federal offense, I suppose.
Yeah.
But it is said to show the kind of disparate standards that are being used to kill Yugoslavians, and at the same time to keep, in essence, a reign of fear going here in Santa Cruz.
It was a really excellent letter in the Sentinel the other day from Jane Bear,
yeah.
Talking about where are the peace demonstrators? You know, is it because we have a Democratic president, and traditionally the peace mongers are Democrats, and therefore no one, you know, have we lost our soul? In other words, and I think it's quite clear that we have.
Well, it's always been the case that these wars get started under Democrats. I mean, you know, Barry Goldwater could never have started the Vietnam War.
Absolutely.
But the Democratic majority under Lyndon Johnson rushed right ahead. Similarly, in Congress, although we seem to have some positive signs when they got tied up 213-213 last week.
Well, and it's so interesting for me to see these Republicans up there giving their dove position.
Pat Buchanan, the peacemaker.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's just the role reversal is really it would be comical if it weren't for the fact that women and children were dying every day.
Yeah. Buses, Albanian kids killed yesterday, I count as the seventh or eighth bombing of civilians.
Inadvertent bombing of civilians.
Of course, it was an error, and we are really sorry about that.
Right.
But it really is Milosevic's fault because he's the one who provoked it. You see.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's his fault.
Yeah.
Anyway. Getting back to the sleeping van case, which seems really pretty trivial compared to the murders that are occurring overseas, the state murders that are occurring overseas, still, here's old Dennis. He's got to call up the court every day to find out if they're issuing yet another warrant, because for him, the consequences are severe. If he gets arrested under this warrant, they confiscate his van.
That's right.
And they confiscate his van. He has to pay an amount of money that he probably can't afford to get it out, or the money goes up every day as part of this racket that the tow company has with the sheriff's department.
Absolutely.
So is there a way, are you looking at a way to get some kind of court action, like a writ of mandate?
If I had the time, I would be on it in a heartbeat. I've worked all day yesterday. I'm going to be working all day today. I have absolutely no time. So if somebody out there wants to lend a hand to give me some assistance in doing something like this, it'd be terrific. But I'm absolutely buried in work
so
right
any
now.
So any people with any legal expertise or just a willingness to do some legwork, research work, give a call to 423-HUFF. That's the Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom line, 423-4833, and I will put you in touch with attorney Kate Wells, with whom we've been talking for the last 40 minutes. Kate, anything more, actually more like 25 minutes, but how long is there more you'd like to give us, you think, that any other things coming up we should know about?
Well, I think that there's a real schism happening in the sheriff's department right now. There's an attitude on the part of a small minority of the sheriffs that basically, in fact, this was a statement that was actually made by Lieutenant Hartness, that we are the cops, we can do anything we want. And I think that they're trying to prove that in a most abhorrent way, and
when did Lieutenant Hartness make this statement?
He made it to Richard probably about 2 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
And tried to make it out like it was a joke.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly was not a joke. It's an outrage what's happening. Several of the good sheriffs that will remain nameless, obviously, to protect him, who are my friends, have said that they're outraged about what's happening, that there are lying, cheating cops who are being protected by the administration, and there's a conspiracy of silence. Everyone's afraid to speak out. Evidently, several of these officers have gone to the union leaders to say, look, I've seen this happen, and the union leaders are telling them, just keep quiet. So I think that we have a real lack of leadership in the sheriff's department. These sorts of things never happened. There have been a flood, an absolute flood of cases against the county for Ms. Prision in the sheriff's department. County council's office is concerned about it.
By this you mean like police brutality?
Absolutely. Excessive force, entering on property illegally, trespassing.
Specific stats on this, or?
No, but I know the county council's office is suddenly very concerned about it. There has been a huge increase in the number of lawsuits. And I know that in the old days I never had an action against the sheriff's department. I was very, very rare that I did. They were always against either Capitol PD, SCPD, or...
Well, I do remember the Liberty case. That was pretty horrible.
Right. No, there are a few exceptions, but
Deputy Liberty, of course, was the deputy who beat up a Scotts Valley resident on videotape.
Right.
And the district attorney, then District Attorney Art Danner, refused to even look at the videotape when all the victim wanted, Nichols, I guess his name was.
He ended up paying $350,000 as a result of it.
All he wanted was an apology.
Right.
And they took it to federal court, and he got $300,000. I thought it was $500,000, $350,000,
something like that. Anyway, I'm out of here. Hope I left you with some food for thought.
Hey, thank you very much, Kate Wells. And
okay.
If there are any attorneys out there who want to help out, you know who to call.
Yeah, please.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Saturday night. Saturday night struts down the street with his hands in his pockets as if he could overthrow any government with only the slightest sneer of his lower lip. Saturday night is as old as injustice and much better looking, and he knows it, too. And Saturday night is real, the way a dog embracing a fire hydrant is real, and the police are not. The way a young girl taking her profile to a party is real, and the conversation is not. There are shadows who can destroy the world, but they can never be anything more than shadows. I won't use their language. I am not sure of my own reality. I am only a loosely knit central committee of conflicting selves, and the internal bickering is unbelievable, like everybody. But I want the words to come crawling out of me like lines of ants appearing in the kitchen as soon as it starts to rain. Inevitable. As if they owned the place and had always been there, and I were only a vague, disruptive ecology or an angry god, but not real. The way a speck of food ants harvest off an unwashed plate is real. The way women with their hair tied up in kerchiefs harvesting grain on a rocky island are real, and the government is not. I want those women to dig my poems out of the calloused earth and sing my poems into the wrinkled sky while there's another bloody palace coup. I want factory men with blowtorches to assemble my poems while company owners with paper eyes shuffle away their jobs. I want the ants to wave my poems on their antennae as they climb cliffs of glass piled in the kitchen sink. I want Saturday night to slit his eyes and decide my poems are worth stealing. I want my poems to be real, even after I turn on the faucet, exasperated. Even after the unjust shadows push the button and the world ends. A fire hydrant. Dogs. Ants. Rocks. Wine. Saturday night. People. Freedom.
The apples ripe upon the bough, the orange on the tree.
The hands were black that picked the fruit for you, but not for me.
Diamonds shining in the rock, gleaming white and blue.
10 hours a day in the diamond mines for me, but not for you.
A sea of grass and a mountain range is beckoning the free.
A place to walk with head held high for you, but not for me.
The burning sun of Africa, the sky that's always blue.
Apartheid and the past laws for me, but not for you.
A big land, a rich land, stretched from sea to sea.
And all the riches of the earth for you, but not for me.
A big land, a gracious land, a land where old meets new.
The bullets fired at Sharpeville were for me, but not for you. You've planted seeds of fear and hate in all who would be free. At harvest time, the fruit will be for you and not for me.
And we're on the line now with community activist Phil Baer. Hi, Phil.
Hello there.
Hey, Phil. What a voice. I got to turn down this mic a bit.
Boom.
Hey, man. Well, you're not just a gadfly, but you're a man who actually had significant impact on the last city election, who saved a very valuable piece of property for the city here, and at least I hope it stays saved. And you're now fighting, I guess, the same kind of fight that you were fighting 6 to 9 months ago to preserve the Beach Flats area and to stop the demolition of housing there, ironically under the pretext of more housing going in, more and better housing. Can you tell us something about that?
Yes, it's a new proposal, basically quite similar to the proposal that we thought we had defeated. We defeated the specific proposal, but not the concept, apparently. This one, I suppose, slightly better in some respects, but more objectionable in other respects. This one's called the Vernon Lee Project, I mean the Dolphin Lee Project, referring to the names of the two properties as they are now named, that would be somehow acquired by the city and the existing housing demolished to provide the site for a new housing project. One of the downsides of this one that makes it even less desirable than the earlier incarnation is the fact that some much larger number of people would actually be displaced by this site, something between 150 and 200 people at least, perhaps more, who would simply be moved out of their present homes, given some sort of temporary subsidy on their rent for perhaps as long as 42 months, certainly no longer than that, and possibly less long than that, after which these people, by virtue of being very low on income people, would not qualify for the housing that would be built. Their subsidy would run out, and in short order they would be evicted and in all likelihood on the street.
We're talking about Hispanic people, right?
Almost 100% in this particular situation, yes.
Dare I call this ethnic cleansing?
You dare.
But certainly our progressive Santa Cruz City Council, Fitzmaurice, Cronin, Sugar, are opposed to such a thing.
Well, I still like our guys, maintain some sort of faith in their intentions at least, but find them to be unaware of the full complications and ramifications of the project. To them, it's rather on the level of taking out some housing that they think is not too nice, to replace it with housing that they think would be better. Their assumption, I think, being that essentially the same people as live there now would be able to live in the new and improved housing. But I, having dealt with this before and really quizzed the developer on the requirements, am persuaded that that's not true in several regards. The people, particularly, the people who would lose the housing would not be eligible for the new housing that would be built. One of the basic flaws. It is, unbeknownst to our new guys, it involves a certain level of gentrification. That is to say, lower income people would be replaced by less low income people. The term affordable in the context of these plans having been so hoard is to be almost meaningless now. Affordable can be defined from anything down to as high as, I've heard the term affordable used to describe housing that would be available to those earning 140% of the average income in this area, which is a whole bunch of money. More than you or I could even count, right. Much less pocket.
Well, certainly when you say that our guys, as you put them.
Oh, yeah, possessive.
Our guy, or your guys, as I guess we should call
okay.
them.
Okay.
Your guys know nothing about this. Are you saying that you have been unable in your busy schedule to let them know what you've just told us all on the air?
Well, you know, people are really kind of dense, our guys included. And in their defense, they're overextended and being given some misleading information from the developer, and and probably from certain staffers and from a lot of other progressive types who are still of the naive opinion that affordable means affordable and things like that, and have not been given a specific proposal. You know, the details have not been worked out in terms of exactly who would be eligible for the housing, how much it would cost, who would pay for it, how they would acquire the land, how the people would be selected. There are numerous details where people just assume that the city has a great deal of control over the selection of the people who live there. You'll recall Neary's Lagoon and Sycamore Apartments, both were presented to the community as solutions to the so-called Beach Flats housing problem, as if the people in Beach Flats would be the residents of Sycamore and Neary's, and for various reasons having to do with eligibility and the process by which they are required to select their tenants according to the regulations at the state and federal level, who are kicking in most of the money. For various reasons, very few people from Beach Flats got into either of those housing projects, so they served almost 0% to solve the so-called Beach Flats housing problem.
Mercy Housing is, I guess, the city's designated developer here.
Yes.
Can you tell us something about Mercy Housing and whether you are concerned that that particular group is involved in this project?
Well, I'm concerned that a process like this is given to a developer through sort of a sole source process rather than taking proposals from a number of prospective developers and then choosing the most desirable one. It provides an overly chummy relationship, and there's no competitive element that might get the cost of these things down. I also have little reason to believe that Mercy is particularly current in its understanding of the wide range of ways in which affordability can be achieved. They're still hung up on this 70s prototype of these large, all affordable projects, which have proven to be almost instant problems that sort of segregate and isolate and create a kind of territorialism and sense of being different rather than included and integrated into the broader community. You know, numerous problems that have been identified all up and down the country 20 years ago still have a lot of credibility here for some reason. We're the last bastion of certain discredited approaches to some things, like we're hanging on to some sort of faith in a way that it's really quite misplaced in this particular instance. There are other housing providers that seem to be much more creative in terms of helping low-income people just sort of slip subtly and comfortably into the rest of the community rather than ghettoize and quarantine them the way we have at Neary's, for example.
Who would those be?
Well, there's one that impresses me a lot in San Francisco called Bridge Housing Development. Do a lot of things that mixed income things, a certain percentage, various percentile distributions of affordable housing versus market rate housing. So you're basically mixing people of low income with people of moderate income.
Hasn't the city council kind of shown its face already on this issue when, I guess, our much-ignored city law, which requires percentages of low-income or affordable housing, is essentially being bought off? I mean, didn't we see that happen a couple city council meetings ago?
With the Maynard Manson project.
Right.
It appeared that way to me. That was a 97-unit rental unit project that was approved a week or so ago after what I thought was inadequate bargaining between the city and the developer. So the end result is that there's token affordability at best, and a lot of concessions made by the city to the developer that almost eliminate any real advantage to the city in terms of actually trying to help people of modest income.
Specific concessions being?
The taxes on it were deferred for a long time. That is to say, the incremental property tax increase that would result from the construction was deferred back to the developer and away from, I guess it would have ultimately wound up in the hands of the redevelopment agency because it's in a redevelopment district. The affordability requirement, the 15% of all new housing that is supposed to be affordable according to the inclusionary ordinance passed by the city voters in 79, that was waived. I believe that there are no affordable units in it, or they redefined affordable in that way so as to be eligible to the upper, to the 100%, the median income within the area, so meaning that the rent itself is way high, and they're just calling solidly middle class people low income, in essence, having adjusted the numbers in that way. Things like that, you know, it really, in terms of the what I understood to be the intent of Proposition O, that is to say, cause private developers, with the help of the city, to provide housing, 15% of any new housing constructed would be available to what I think the people were thinking were going to really be people of low income, not middle class people who happen to pull the lucky straw.
You know, Phil, I think it's particularly important because in the years, well, the decade after 1979, when O was passed, you had Reagan essentially gutting housing starts nationally. And now you have the city council moaning about national policies and how come you're picking on us around the homeless. It's the national policies that are to blame. Activist Scott Graham suggested he had a concern about Mercy Housing and that it kind of retains control of the property later. It owns the property.
Yes.
Is that a legitimate concern?
As far as I understand it, though, I've never been able to get a clear sense of how that goes. My understanding, which I'll hang on to until somebody disproves it, is that that Mercy Housing is in fact the owner of the housing. They assume an obligation to maintain whatever the identified level of affordability is for a set period of time, maybe less than 15 years, I don't think any longer than 15 years, after which they're free to do whatever they want to with it, really, including sell it off as condos or what have you. It's very peculiar to me. CHC was the same way before Mercy Housing. A general partnership, a limited partnership rather, the general partner, like the, as I understand the how a general partner, a limited partnership rules, the general partner is almost private sole owner in the same sense that you would be the private sole owner if you bought a house. What was Arnie Fishman, I understand that under those rules, he takes care of the affordability for the designated period of time, at the end of which he can jack up the rents as much he wants, he can sell it, he can do anything. He's basically a millionaire at this point. All of it, or the vast majority of it, financed by public money.
Well, let me ask you this. I know in the last election, Charlie Canfield came in for a lot of criticism of the Seaside Company generally for what seemed to be a Seaside Company push to realign Third Street, expand itself, seize property, destroy housing. and I don't want to say buy up the city council, because I'm not aware of any actual bribes given to the city council, but certainly schmooze up the city council. Is Canfield involved in this process in any way that you know of? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, without sounding too awfully conspiratorial, I've almost come to the conclusion that if anything at all occurs in the main beach area, and to some lesser degree almost anywhere in town, you can be sure that Charles has got a piece of the action. He's everywhere. His investments would constitute a rather lengthy portfolio. I don't know exactly the nature of it here. This one, on the surface of it at least, seems to not too directly involve him. But it's been alleged, for example, that a lot of this subsidized housing that is created winds up becoming the residence of his employees, who qualify for the housing because they earn so little, because he doesn't pay that well, and because they have publicly subsidized housing, they can afford to live in this town on his paltry rig wages. So the public is essentially subsidizing his substandard wage scale. That's cute, isn't it?
It is. It's very cute, and I don't think it's been brought up anywhere that I'm aware of. It's a very interesting and a relevant consideration, and I hope that you bring it before the city council, and I'm sure that after you've said it for 5 or 6 times, maybe Keith Sugar will pick up on it.
That one never knows.
One never knows. Now, there's another issue. There are many issues that you've spoken of. I know reluctantly at first you came out against the sleeping ban, and you urged the city council to show some sense on this issue, to no avail, I might add. But most recently, well, until recently, you were alone.
I didn't reluctantly come out against the sleeping ban. I always identified it as being a very questionable constitutionality.
Well, what I mean by reluctantly is your voice was initially, I would say, not one of the harsher, more uncompromising voices at city council.
No, here. That's your job.
But that was perhaps the job of myself and other people. But I began to hear a change in your voice as you saw them doing nothing. You became quite, I think, outspoken, not necessarily personal, but definitely concerned about the issue in a way that eventually was quite clear and uncompromising.
Well, I've certainly slept on the ground a few times and know that it ain't no Holiday Inn.
You got it. But an issue in which you really have been a kind of a lone ranger for at least a couple of weeks, I guess not entirely, but certainly to a large extent, has been the issue of a state murder from the air in Yugoslavia.
Yes.
Bombing. And now, I guess, they're finally some folks anyway, are beginning to do some organizing. You want to talk a little about that?
Yes, it's a slow raising of the dead on that issue. Very disappointing non-response from the places where one would expect anti-war movement to rise spontaneously in a situation like this. A lot of people and organizations have been conspicuously silent, and everybody waiting around for certain organizations to take a leadership role and not having them do so, and finally...
You could be referring perhaps to the Resource Center for Scott Kennedy, also known as the Resource Center for Nonviolence.
Well, I'm certainly not impressed by the role that they've taken in this, and anybody has a right to whatever opinion they like, but there's a certain problem here because there's a perception that's a, you know, a hardcore, consistent peace movement that's going to be out there on the damn street anytime anybody's dropping bombs on anybody, and that has certainly not been the case in this situation.
So, I know the people who have shown up have been the Santa Cruz Coalition to End the Bombing in Serbia, which helped organize the teach-in
yes.
on campus.
Bright bunch of young people from up at UCSC. also a very impressive group forming at Cabrillo, the real cream of those respective institutions.
Do we have any upcoming protests or demonstrations or meetings that we should know about?
Well, we're doing a protest at the town clock, placards and such. Actually, did a little march down the mall the other night. We're doing it every Monday and Friday. The Women's League for Peace and Freedom is sort of officially involved in that, and other organizations probably, though the thing has, at this point, a remarkably ad hoc kind of quality with various people coming at it from various perspectives, and everybody, or at least I should say myself, so sort of disillusioned by the organizations and the professional peaceniks that we're insisting that it not be presented as on behalf of such and such an organization. You know, just a bunch of people who are concerned about the bombing, and it's gathering some steam, and it's got that exciting kind of quality of something maybe a little bit slow on the get up, but germinating rapidly and just being right, you know.
Well, I know that there are a couple of things. Like, I guess May 3rd, there's supposed to be a, I'm trying to remember. I know there was a series of things at the last.
May 3rd, I think, is the Resource Center for Nonviolence lecture by a fellow named Maharzo at Loudoun Nelson.
And what time is that?
I think it's a 7. I hope so, anyway. I believe that's true.
So I know that the last time I went to the Loudoun Nelson on this issue, I didn't get a lecture. I got to see, and it was a rare experience, action. We saw a lot of people in a room, and you were one of them, scurrying around, forming committees, working rapidly, talking, arguing, but all with the aim of getting some kind of a movement off the ground.
Yeah, it was a good meeting, wasn't it?
50 people in that room.
At least. I counted more.
Wow. And has that been borne out in the last week, our committee?
I think that one is moving. There's a real sense of momentum on that one. They are working on two forums, the first on the 12th, I believe, at the Vets Hall. Norman Solomon, Bill Monning, and Dimitri Dinopoulos, I believe is the name, a professor of Balkan studies or some such field like that from maybe San Jose State, supposed to be very first-hand knowledgeable of the area at the Vets Hall at that one, I think, is 6:30. I'll double-check these dates, get back to you if I'm wrong.
Sure.
And then a big one that we're aiming for June 2nd in the Civic, where we're talking to a number of people, including Tom Campbell, not yet confirmed, but we're working on him, and Dennis Bernstein of KPFA, and Michael Parenti, very dynamic speaker, putting together a real package of people who know the field, and that's going to be a big thing, I do believe. I hope if the field hasn't turned by that time, that event should turn it in this city.
Now, how can people call and help? Do you have a number of people can call?
Well, anybody can feel free to call me, 423-0170.
That's 423-0170. All you folks that have pencils, run, get a pencil. And we're talking to activist Phil Baer, active in the fight to end the bombing of Yugoslavia.
Yes, I'm really, I thought Jesse Jackson did a very cool thing. That picture on today's Sentinel of him holding hands in prayer with Slobodan Milosevic and getting those three American POWs, or whatever they are officially called, out was fairly major cool. Did a big job towards humanizing those.
Well, I kind of
Slavs.
I hear you. I kind of wish though that Jackson would simply come out against the bombing, period, instead of playing this man in the middle role. But I guess,
he has to maintain a certain amount of neutrality, I think, or he wouldn't even get his
visa.
Well, yeah.
He could go by Cuba, then, maybe.
Yes, conceivably so. I understand Cuba had got some enormous number of people at a rally just within the last few days. It was basically an anti-NATO bombing rally.
Well, I know that today's LA Times, in an update, they have a great HTTP site for those of you with a computer. Go to the LA Times, look for it as a keyword. The report was, and maybe in today's Sentinel, that Clinton essentially said, we don't care, we're going to keep bombing. It doesn't matter to us that these three people were released. I mean, it's
yes.
good, but it's all Milosevic's fault. And until they accept the terms laid down by the Rambouillet Accords, which I'm going to talk about after we're finished speaking,
cool.
That the bombing will continue in spite of the fact that we're getting increased reports of deaths of children, innocent civilian deaths, Bulgarians getting bombed,
yes.
Montenegrins getting bombed by mistake.
Right. And even more telling to me is what seems to me the clear lack of substantiation for all of these atrocities alleged to the Serbians. It seems to me by this point we would be able to provide something by way of documentation and courtroom-type evidence that all of these thousands of rapes and thousands of murders are being committed. I'm finding that stuff increasingly more difficult to believe because of the lack of any sort of real confirmation at all.
Yeah, I mean, you're getting anecdotal evidence from refugees.
Exactly.
And there are.
And all of which has a very choreographed quality to me.
Well, there are contentions.
Cry into the camera, you know.
Right. Well, I'm not going to second guess the refugees at this point, but I think that if you compare the number of, I mean, just the initial reports of 2,000, which is the KLA upper number, of Albanians killed by Serbian forces or Yugoslavian forces, and you contrast that with the number, I guess, 10,000 or 20,000. Kurds killed by the Turks in the last 5 years.
Oh, I think a far greater number than that.
But NATO has wisely decided it's not going to bomb its own members or
yes.
place human rights restrictions on its own gangsters, so
yes.
to speak. Its own gangster governments are supposed to be supporting this, but in fact, of course, what is it, 80 or 90% of the support is coming from the U.S.
Yes.
And what is the U.S. doing in a European organization bombing Yugoslavia when
right.
the European countries themselves are not
sufficiently right.
interested to do it? It looks to me like, the wires are being pulled from Washington, D.C.
I would have to agree. I guess there's a certain amount of encouragement from what I would consider the right wing of Germany.
And Tony Blair's government.
Tony Blair, Bill Clinton's attack dog.
Right.
Such an attack dog. Not to be afraid.
Woof woof.
Yeah.
I want to thank you, Phil, for being on the air with us. Is there anything you want to conclude with, or stuff that I haven't mentioned that you think should be brought up?
Well, I'm more and more convinced that the United States government has played a deliberate strategy of starving the Serbian people with economic sanctions while aggravating, arming, and financing any sort of ethnic extremist mentality that they could find in the area, that they did it in Croatia, they did it in Bosnia, they've done it very completely with the KLA in Kosovo, and it's basically an attempt to shatter that independent Yugoslavian nation with a fairly reasonable track record in terms of multi-ethnic toleration and a fairly reasonable quality of life for the people of its country, regardless of their ethnicity, break that up into a bunch of warring little tribal states, none of which will be able to be truly independent states, so that they can all function as like NATO protectorates to be exploited as a cheap labor source for the big global international corporations. It's very sinister to me. I don't trust the American rationale one bit.
And again, those who want to help you, I guess the next time we'll be hearing from you, we'll be seeing you down at the town block tomorrow at 5:15 with the Women's International.
Yes, please join us. Kind of fun.
And also, I guess on Tuesday, the City Council is having its so-called town hall meeting. Any comments on that?
Well, that is an excellent forum. I would suggest that people get there to say whatever they want to talk about. It's supposed to be sort of open-ended and loose in format. It's time to give the council an earful. That's the occasion to do it. I hope everybody gets down there and does their thing.
Okay. Well, you've been listening to Phil Baer, whose phone number again is
423-0170.
423-0170 if you want to help fight the bombing, learn more about Dolphin Lee, or simply, who knows?
The inside scoop about Robert Norse.
Hey, man, you catch all the details from Phil. He's been compiling a dossier on me. He and backroom activity.
Hot stuff.
Hey, thank you, Phil.
Thank you, Robert.
Bye-bye.
Well, I used to preach white power and that freedom could be won. By teaching kids to hate blacks and Jews and how to fire a gun. It was Aryan revolution and a race war to the death. If it hadn't been for Sylvia, I'd never caught my breath. But now I've felt love and can never return. Love's a long, hard road, but it's not too late to learn. I used to stand for violence, but now I know the score. And I don't want to fight for hate no more. It was from a very early age that I was taught to hate. Mixing